American Army has spent weeks leveling the city of Aachen. At 10 a.m. this morning, the famous resort town became the first German municipality to fall into Allied hands. There is widespread hope that this marks the beginning of the end for the Nazi war machine, and that the fighting will end by New Year's Eve. Eisenhower smokes and paces. The 54-year-old general played football back in his West Point days, but now carries a small paunch and walks with his shoulders rolled forward. For security purposes, there is not a situation map tacked to the plywood partition in his office. Instead, he carries details of the German, British, and American armies in his head. Eisenhower endures a daily barrage of worries. If anything, his life since becoming Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces in Europe has been one headache after another, punctuated by moments of world-changing success. But new expectations torment Ike. His boss, the four-star General George Marshall, has set in stone New Year's Eve as the last day of the war. Ike believes that the proposed deadline will be impossible, hence the deep frown lines on his high forehead. Marshall is back in Washington, 3,500 miles from the front. He is chief of staff of the Army and chief military advisor to President Roosevelt. No other officer in the combined Allied armies has more power and influence than this lean, tough-talking Pennsylvanian. Marshall's return to the United States came after a week-long tour of the European Theater of Operations. Now he has cabled Eisenhower his great displeasure about the strategic situation. The October pause that enrages George Patton infuriates Marshall as well. He's demanding an end to the stalemate. Everything possible must be done to attack deep into Germany and end the war by January 1st. Per Marshall's orders, this is to include the use of weapons currently considered top secret, and the placement of every single American, British, and Canadian soldier onto the front lines. Nothing must be held back. Eisenhower must find a way. Orders are orders, and his success has been largely based on obeying them, unlike George Patton. So Ike smokes one cigarette after another. A few top American generals are coming over for dinner tonight. That celebration of victory at Aachen can wait until then. Across the hall, pale autumn light floods the glass-walled foyer, where a bronze bust of German Air Force Commander Hermann Göring has been turned to face the wall. Eisenhower smokes another cigarette. He doesn't have a favorite brand, and he doesn't know how many packs he smokes each day. The number is actually four packs, as evidenced by his yellow-stained fingertips and the stench from his trademark waist-length Ike jacket. His breath reeks of cigarettes and the countless pots of coffee he drinks each day. Nicotine and caffeine are the only ways Eisenhower can manage the stress. He certainly can't play golf in the midst of the war, and right now it's still several hours too early for either a weak scotch and water, time alone in his upstairs apartment with a dime store cowboy novel, or perhaps even a furtive romantic liaison with Kay Summersby, his personal chauffeur. At age 36, the divorced Irish brunette, who wears a captain's rank, has been assigned to Ike for 2 years. At first, she was merely his driver, a member of Britain's all-volunteer mechanized transport corps, assigned to guide Eisenhower's official Packard sedan through the blacked-out streets of London. Eisenhower admired her confidence behind the wheel and arranged for Summersby to be transferred permanently to the U.S. Military Women's Army Corps, where she was commissioned as an officer. The turning point in their relationship came in June 1943, when the American colonel to whom Summersby was engaged got blown up by a landmine in Tunisia. It was Eisenhower who held Kay in his arms as she sobbed in grief. A spark passed between them in that moment, and the relationship deepened. Now the former fashion model has become Eisenhower's chief confidant. She travels with him everywhere and even sits in on high-level meetings, which makes her privy to top-secret war strategy. The two chatter and laugh constantly, passing the rare moments away from the pressure of the war by riding horses or playing bridge. Summersby has even gotten Eisenhower in the habit of taking tea each afternoon at 4, just like the British do. He is so used to her constant presence that recently, while back in America for a short leave, Ike infuriated his wife, Mamie, by calling her Kay on two different occasions. The close relationship between Summersby and Eisenhower goes on in secret most of the time, but as John Thompson of the Chicago Tribune noted, their fondness for each other surfaces publicly now and then. I've never seen before a chauffeur get out of a car and kiss the general good morning, Thompson told American Major General James M. Gavin when asked if the rumors were true. No less than President Franklin Delano Roosevelt can see the sparks between Summersbee and Ike. After the landmark Tehran Conference in 1943, FDR confided to his daughter Anna that he thought Eisenhower and his chauffeur were sleeping together. In many ways, Eisenhower is a victim of his own success. Even though he has never once fought in battle, he has risen through the ranks and accumulated power through intellect, shrewd diplomacy, and most of all, finding ingenious ways of turning the outrageous demands of men such as George Marshall into reality. The problem is his forces are as stuck and immobile now as they were a month ago. The shortage of gas, guns, and bullets that ground George Patton to a halt outside Metz still affects all the Allied forces up and down their 500-mile front lines. If there is one positive about the situation, it is that for the first time in ages, George Patton is not at the top of Eisenhower's long list of problems in need of solving. August 3, 1943, more than a year prior, Patton is visiting the 15th Evacuation Hospital near the Sicilian city of Nicosia. He's exhausted after three straight weeks of managing the American attack on Italy, pushing his army past the unharvested fields of grain and the vineyards where ripened grapes dangle in enormous bunches. American and British forces are racing from the southern shores of Sicily to Messina in the island's north, where they hope to trap and capture the German army before its soldiers can flee to the Italian mainland. The fighting has been tough, with thousands killed on both sides. Patton's army has captured more than 20,000 German and Italian soldiers, as well as thousands of Sicilian peasants forced to fight for the Nazi cause. Always determined to win, Patton is now more driven than ever because operational priority has been assigned to his arch-rival, British General Bernard Law Montgomery. Monty was given a plum landing spot in Sicily on the coastal plains near Syracuse. British leadership, who had operation control of the battlefield, ordered Patton's army to slug it out with the Axis defenders in the rugged Sicilian mountains. This Patton cannot allow, nor can he stand to hear any more British gossip about Americans being inferior soldiers. He's determined to beat Monty into Messina and win glory for his army despite the obstacles thrown in his way. This is a horse race in which the prestige of the U.S. Army is at stake. "We must take Messina before the British," he writes to one of his commanding generals. "Please use your best efforts to facilitate the success of our race." The end of the race is still 2 weeks away as Patton visits a small field hospital in the crags of Sicily's central highlands. His love of fighting men is profound and extends to the aftermath of battle, where he's fond of personally presenting the wounded with their Purple Hearts, a medal recognizing injury during the course of combat. The air smells of antiseptic and dust. Men lie on litters and improvised beds, their eyes glassy from sedatives. Many have had their hands, faces, and torsos wrapped in gauze, speckled here and there with blood that has soaked through the dressings. Nurses and doctors weave through the sea of men, managing their pain the best they can before determining who will be sent back to the front and who will be transferred to a hospital far behind the lines for further treatment. All, Patton will write in his journal tonight, were brave and cheerful. All except one soldier. Private Charles Kewell of the 1st Infantry Division sits on the edge of a stool. He's being treated for exhaustion and anxiety. This is his third trip to the field hospital for this diagnosis in his 8 short months in the Army. Patton spots him. "Why are you here?" the general demands, his nerves on edge. The race to Messina has him taking dangerous tactical chances. The ego that has so often defined him has pushed him to his emotional limit. "I guess I can't take it, sir." Patton seethes. "You coward," he bellows. "Leave this tent at once." Kewell remains motionless, sitting straight up at attention. The silence so unnerves Patton that he explodes. The general slaps Kewell hard across the face with the gloves he is holding. He then lifts Kewell off the stool by the collar of his uniform, shoves him toward the exit, and kicks him hard in the rear end. "You hear me, you yellow bastard. You're going to the front," Patton screams. The doctors and nurses working the small hospital are horrified. Yet surprisingly, they soon move on from the incident. As a professional soldier, Patton thinks nothing of it. Indeed, when news of the confrontation starts to spread and eventually reaches his German counterparts, they are mystified that anyone would be bothered in the slightest by Patton's treatment of Kuehl. In the German army, such men are not slapped, they're forced to their knees, and a bullet is shot through their brain. Patton writes as much in his journal that night. Companies should deal with such men, and if they shirk their duty, they should be tried for cowardice and shot. The press knows Patton's arrogance. The British understand his competitive nature. The Germans believe him to be America's top general. But now, he's battling his own generals, who, despite the rapid American advance toward Messina, are appalled by Patton's willingness to embrace unnecessary danger. But only those close to him understand how emotional he becomes at the sight of wounded American soldiers. He is deeply moved by their bravery and thus cannot stand the sight of those he considers cowardly. 2 days after the slapping Kuehl, Patton writes a memo to each of his commanders ordering them not to allow men suffering from combat fatigue to receive medical care. Quote, "Such men are cowards and bring disgrace to their comrades," he writes, "whom they heartlessly leave to endure the danger of battle while they themselves use the hospital as a means of escape. You will see that such cases are not sent to the hospital." On August 10th, as Allied troops approach Messina and Nazi soldiers begin evacuating to the Italian mainland, Patton visits the 93rd Evacuation Hospital in Santo Stefano, a city nestled in a long green valley. Patton steps from his staff car after a long drive through the twisting mountain roads and is surprised to see a soldier without battle dressings or a splint sitting among the litters. "And what's happened to you?" Patton asks the young man. His name is Private Paul Bennett. He has been in the Army 4 years, serving with C Battery of the 17th Field Artillery Regiment. He's just 21 years old. Until a friend died in combat, he had never once complained about battle. But now he shakes from convulsions. His red-rimmed eyes brim with tears. "It's my nerves, sir. I can't stand the shelling anymore." "Your nerves, hell. You're just a goddamn coward." Bennett begins sobbing. Patton slaps him. "Shut up," he orders, his voice rising. "I won't have these brave men here who've been shot see a yellow bastard sitting here crying." Patton hits him again, knocking off Bennett's helmet, which falls to the dirt floor. "You're a disgrace to the Army, and you're going back to the front to fight," he screams. "You ought to be lined up against a wall and shot. In fact, I ought to shoot you right now." Patton pulls his ivory-handled pistol from his holster with his right hand. With his left, he backhands Bennett across the face with such force that nearby doctors rush to intervene. The medical staff is disturbed by Patton's actions and file a report. Word of the incident soon reaches Eisenhower. "I must so seriously question," Ike writes to Patton on August 16th, "your good judgment and your self-discipline as to raise serious doubts in my mind as to your future usefulness." But that is to be the end of it. Eisenhower needs Patton's tactical genius. As Assistant Secretary of War John J. McCloy will later remind Ike, Abraham Lincoln was faced with similar concerns about the leadership of General Ulysses S. Grant. "I can't spare this man," Lincoln had responded to those calling for Grant's dismissal. "He fights." Patton fights. Field Marshal Bernard Law Montgomery is in his command post far from the front lines when he receives news that lead elements of the British Army are now marching into Messina. Montgomery beams. He believes he has won the race. Brigadier J.C. Curry of the British 4th Armored Division, who will lead the British forces as they enter the ancient city, has even brought along bagpipes to celebrate their victory. Curry and his commandos enter Messina. Many of the men are perched on the exterior of their American-style Sherman tanks as the overjoyed people of Messina spill into the streets and throw bouquets of flowers at them. But when the British column rumbles into the town center, Curry is shocked to see American soldiers standing in formation. Their uniforms are filthy from days of fighting, and many are so exhausted they can barely stand. But they have clearly won the race. And then, even as Curry struggles to make sense of this surprising scenario, General George Patton rumbles into the piazza in his specially modified Jeep command car, its 3-star pennants on either side of the front hood flapping in the breeze. Patton's arrogant grin is not lost on Curry. The British general has no choice but to step from his Sherman tank and extend a hand in greeting. "It was a jolly good race," Curry concedes to Patton. "I congratulate you." Patton shakes Curry's hand and thanks him. He revels in the victory and in the look of surprise on the British officer's face. "I think the general is quite sore that we had got there first," Patton writes in his journal that night. Any doubts about the efficacy of the American fighting men are now banished, thanks to George Patton. His picture graces the cover of Time magazine. President Roosevelt hails him as a national hero. To the victor go the spoils, and Patton's glory spreads worldwide. But that glory will be short-lived. Despite Eisenhower's best attempts to cover up the slapping incident, the story is leaked to the press. For 3 months, nothing happens. Patton personally apologizes to both soldiers and to the medical staff who witnessed his actions. And for a time, the matter seems settled. But Ernest Cuneo, a liaison officer in the Office of Strategic Services, leaks details of the slaps to NBC radio correspondent Drew Pearson, who announces the story to the nation on November 21, 1943. Public outrage leads the American Congress to call for Patton's immediate dismissal, even in the face of his battlefield triumphs. "I've been a passenger floating on the river of destiny," he writes to Beatrice, adding a hopeful comment. "At the moment, I can't see around the next bend, but I guess it will be all right." Patton is correct. Ike firmly believes that Patton's methods are deplorable, and he fears that Patton's ego is so monumental that he will sacrifice the lives of other men to gain greater fame. But Patton fights, and more than anything else, Eisenhower needs fighters. By October 21, 1944, Eisenhower passes a quiet afternoon in his villa at the Hotel Trianon, and Hitler plots far to the east in the Wolf's Lair. The fall of Messina, a distant memory. Since then, Dwight Eisenhower, a man whose keen sense of self-preservation has led him from civilian obscurity to wartime fame, did something extremely unusual. He defied the U.S. Congress and protected George Patton. Patton has repaid Eisenhower's largesse by enraging Russia, defying orders, instructing soldiers of the Third Army to steal gasoline and other supplies from other U.S. armies, and openly sulking when he is not. "I am not usually inclined to grumble or to think the cards are stacked against me," Patton wrote to Beatrice during the Metz offensive, "but sometimes I wish that someone would get committed to do something for me." Still, Patton fights, and Patton wins. Army Air Corps General Jimmy Doolittle compared the relationship to that between a fighting dog and its master. Quote, "When Eisenhower releases Patton," Doolittle notes, "it's like a releasing an English pit bull. Once you let him go, it's hard to make him stop." What Eisenhower doesn't know is that Adolf Hitler is furtively sending soldiers, tanks, and artillery toward a weakness in the American lines near the Ardennes Forest of Belgium, and that Operation Watch on the Rhine will utilize radio silence and deception in ways that will veil the attack from the Allied forces until it is far too late for them to effectively block it. Eisenhower lives in the moment, trying to balance the many needs and demands of his lonely job. He has absolutely no idea how he will end the war by New Year's Eve, but taking Aachen in Germany is certainly a good start. The time, once again, to unleash his prized pit bull is about to arrive. Chapter 4, Bolshoi Theater, Moscow, Russia, October 14, 1944, 7 p.m. The house lights are up in Moscow's legendary Bolshoi Theater as Olga Lepeshinskaya waits in the wings. The 28-year-old prima ballerina adjusts her costume and stretches her long, willowy legs as she prepares to take the stage. The acoustics in this legendary auditorium are among the best in the world, allowing Olga to hear with utter clarity the sounds of the last-minute tunings of violins and clarinets rising from the orchestra pit, and also vivid snippets of conversation from the more than 2,000 Russians noisily filing into their seats. She can hear their words of eagerness about enjoying the sold-out Saturday night performance and the relief in their voices that after many hard-fought years, the tide of the war is turning in their favor. Ever since Adolf Hitler ordered his armies to attack more than 3 years ago, the people of the Soviet Union, or Russia as it is still commonly known, have seen more than 10 million of their men and boys in uniform die. Amazingly, an equal number of civilians have also perished, done in by military bombardment, random shooting of innocent women and children, and starvation. The German invaders cut off food supplies and appropriated harvests for themselves. Moving quickly and ruthlessly, the German war machine advanced 1,000 miles from its own borders to the outskirts of Moscow before being repelled. At one point, German tanks and infantry stood just 22 miles from where these Moscovites sit right now. But during the past 6 months, fate has turned against the German army. A summer offensive by Soviet forces pushed the Wehrmacht back. The long siege of Leningrad has come to an end. Just a few days ago, that city was lit in the evening after 3 long years of blackouts. Truly, this is a night for all Russians to celebrate. In keeping with the wartime austerity, the once stately Bolshoi no longer sports gold leaf decorations. These have been painted over with a stark white paint, and the seats upholstered in plush crimson have been replaced by hardback chairs that not only fit more bodies into the 90-year-old theater, but also make it possible to stage political rallies here in addition to the world's finest ballet. Thus, the countless hammer and sickle emblems lining the walls. Olga smiles as she peeks her head around the curtain to clandestinely observe the house. Tonight, she will dance Giselle in one of the most famous romantic roles in the ballet. Just having a stage is a luxury, for as part of her wartime service, Olga has performed in woods, meadows, and bombed-out churches to entertain Soviet troops as part of the Bolshoi's 1st Brigade Frontline Theater. Everything about the Bolshoi, the cavernous hall, the polished wood of the stage, and the many boxes lining the walls, feels like an extravagance after dancing in the dirt and rubble of the battlefield. Suddenly, a roar sweeps the crowd. The audience turns and looks upward, to the balcony that houses what was called the Imperial Box back before the days of communist rule. A short, very overweight man bobs down toward his seat at the front of the box. The whole world knows the sight of Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of Great Britain. Why he happens to be in Moscow attending the ballet is a mystery to the crowd, but his presence alone reinforces the solidarity between the Allied forces of the United States, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union. Together, they will surely defeat Hitler and Germany. The ovation is thunderous, and Churchill obliges the audience with a great wave of his hand before taking his seat. As the house lights go down, Olga gazes up at the box where Churchill sits. Her eyes study its other occupants, searching in vain for her lover. She sees American ambassador to the Soviet Union, Averell Harriman, his young daughter, Kathleen, and Soviet diplomat, Molotov, but not the man she longs to see. Then commotion. However, it's dark, and the blinding footlights obscure Olga's view. What could be happening? 20 minutes later, as Olga's flawless dancing once again proves that no one, perhaps with the possible exception of her nemesis, Galina Ulanova, deserves the title of prima ballerina more than she, a quick look up at Churchill's box explains the source of the commotion. For there, sitting next to Churchill, is the unmistakable profile of Olga's lover. He has not been to the ballet once since the war began. The man's face is pockmarked, his left arm shorter than the right, and he is the tiniest person in the box. Olga does not call him by his first name, Osif, not even when they are alone. Instead, she knows him by his adopted name, the one that translates to Man of Steel. Then, strangely, just before the end of the first act, Olga is puzzled to see him move to the back of the box, where he cannot be seen. When the first act of the ballet is complete, the house lights come back up, and the whole audience once again rises to its feet to give Churchill an ovation. But the British leader refuses to bask in the acclaim alone. He beckons to the back of the box, encouraging another man to step forward. So it is that Olga's lover appears and stands at Churchill's right. The Soviet audience applauds thunderously, dazzled to see in the flesh the man whom they alternately love and fear. All hail, Marshal Joseph Stalin. In his lifetime, Stalin will murder millions of people. Some will be shot, others will be denied food and ultimately die of starvation. Millions will be sent to die in the deep winter snows of Siberia, and many will be tortured to death. Already during one infamous murder spree in April and May of 1940, some 22,000 Polish nationals were shot dead. What began as an attempt to execute every member of the Polish officer corps soon expanded to include police officers, landowners, intelligence agents, lawyers, and priests. The shootings were conducted for nights on end, often beginning at dusk and continuing until dawn. Some were mass killings carried out in the forests, while others were individual executions inside prisons. A chief executioner at one of the prisons personally shot 7,000 men in the back of the head as they knelt before him. Those killings took place inside a cell whose walls were lined with sandbags to deaden the sound. As soon as a victim fell dead, he was dragged from the room and thrown onto a truck for delivery to the burial site, while another handcuffed prisoner was marched before the executioner and told to kneel. Noting that Russian pistols had so much recoil that his hand hurt just after a dozen killings, the executioner opted for the smoother feel of a German Walther PPK. The killings continued for 2 long months. In order to prevent global outrage, in case word of the atrocity spread, Stalin ordered his troops to make it seem as if German soldiers had carried out the executions. His cruelty is so perverse that even those who serve him are in constant fear for their lives. Stalin has a standing order that none of his bodyguards are to enter his bedroom, ever. Once, just to test them, he lay on his bed and screamed out in agony. Thinking the Soviet leader was in mortal danger, the guards rushed into the room to save his life. Stalin's scream was fake. He was testing the guards. Each man was then executed for failure to follow orders. Stalin will ultimately order between 50 million and 60 million deaths, far more than his hated rival Adolf Hitler. The entire population of Great Britain is 47 million people. Stalin, in effect, will eventually slaughter the equivalent of every man, woman, and child in Winston Churchill's beloved homeland. He will do so without compassion or guilt, all the while living a life of luxury and debauchery, in stark contrast to the rigors of the communist lifestyle his government imposes. Yet Winston Churchill has not come to Moscow to repudiate Stalin. He has come to befriend him. For even though Stalin and his American counterpart, President Roosevelt, often treat Churchill as a drunken fool, the British leader is a most astute man. He's well aware that Roosevelt and Stalin are making plans to exclude Britain from the redrawing of maps once the war is over. Churchill has flown to Moscow to negotiate directly with Stalin. Tonight he has shown his solidarity with the Soviet leader by requesting that the performance include not just Giselle, but also a special demonstration of songs and dances by the Red Army Choir. Since the evening of October 9th, when Churchill first met with Stalin at the Kremlin, a rather precarious diplomatic dance has been taking place between the two men. The Russians have pushed the German army hundreds of miles back, and it is clear that the Soviet Union will become the reigning superpower in Eastern Europe. Rather than retreating once the war ends, Stalin has indicated that he will occupy countries such as Poland and Hungary. Churchill has no plans to stop him. Britain's global empire has almost been completely lost during the war. He seeks to regain some of the lost territory by dividing control of Europe between the Soviet Union and England. Already, Soviet forces have captured all of eastern Poland. Rather than sympathize with the Polish people who are vowing to fight for their homeland, Churchill upbraids them for being arrogant, for wanting to wreck Europe. "I don't know if the British government will continue to recognize you," Churchill has informed the Polish government, which is now operating in exile. Meanwhile, even though Poland is not his to give away, American President Franklin Roosevelt has already secretly promised the sphere of influence to the Soviets. Even the fearful Polish people themselves cannot foresee the horrors of the day in the not-so-distant future, where every aspect of their lives will be overseen by a secret police loyal to their Soviet masters. They will live in constant fear of being hauled off to Makatov prison in Warsaw, where some of them will be tortured in a most horrific manner. Skulls crushed, fingernails ripped off, torsos beaten with everything from brass rods to rubber truncheons. All because Churchill and Roosevelt gave their nation away to Joseph Stalin in the name of world peace. But the rest of Eastern Europe is still up for grabs. Churchill has brought with him a handwritten piece of paper that he jokingly calls his naughty document. On it, he scratched out the names of Eastern Europe countries and the percentage Great Britain will control. Russia will get 90% of Romania, Britain 10%. Britain will get 90% of Greece, Soviets 10%. And so it goes for each nation in Eastern Europe, Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Hungary, and so on. The negotiations continue for days. Stalin and Churchill go back and forth diplomatically, but the truth is, Stalin has no plans to honor the agreement. Churchill inspired and encouraged the British people during the harrowing early days of the war, when Britain was under daily German attack. But his political mission reflects the darker side of his character. An island nation is in constant need of resources to ensure stability and prosperity. British politician Horace Walpole, speaking 200 years earlier, spoke emphatically about England's need to control other countries so they might provide the wealth Britain's limited size could not. Without these resources, Walpole wrote, we should be reduced to a miserable little island, and from a mighty empire sink to an insignificant country such as Denmark or Sardinia. Then France will dictate to us more imperiously than we ever did to Ireland. Churchill understands this harsh political reality. And though he won't admit it to Stalin, both men know England has already seen its global power seriously diminished. Without the Americans, the Germans most likely would have defeated the British long ago. Even now, as Churchill attempts to seduce a madman, American soldiers flood the streets of London. They are paid a higher salary than their British counterparts and spend it freely. British soldiers seethe at the sight of American GIs with English girls on their arms. But there's nothing the Tommies, as they are called, can do about it. Horace Walpole's prediction has come to pass. Instead of France, as it was in Walpole's time, it is Stalin and the Soviet Union who are now dictating terms to Churchill in Great Britain. Olga Beam, says Joseph Stalin and Winston Churchill, join in the ovation. She has danced Giselle beautifully. The two world leaders now clap their hands enthusiastically to show their approval as the ballet comes to an end. Her days of dancing on the front lines are over. The German threat against Moscow is no more, and those Soviet soldiers fighting their way west into Czechoslovakia and Hungary push the buffer between the Soviet people and imminent peril farther and further into the distance. But Olga does not know that for every mile the Soviet soldiers conquer, their insatiable desire to rape and plunder goes unchecked. In Giselle, such rapists are hunted down by spirits from beyond the grave for their barbarous acts. Yet in the real world, their acts not only go unpunished, but they are seen as acts of heroism by the barbaric Soviet leadership. A large bouquet of roses grown in the warmth of a greenhouse for just this purpose is carried on stage and presented to Olga. The audience is still on its feet. She curtsies as she accepts the blood-red flowers. But when she looks up at the box where her beloved sat just moments ago, he and Winston Churchill have vanished. In 6 days of negotiation, two men have redrawn the map of Europe, but Churchill has been wasting his time. But the Russians have no plans to honor their promises. When the war finally ends, they plan to grab as much land as possible, ensuring that millions of people will soon live their lives under the murderous thumb of Marshal Joseph Stalin. Time to celebrate. Chapter 5, Fenway Park, Boston, Massachusetts, November 4th, 1944, 9 p.m. The man with 5 months to live surveys the joyous crowd as he revels in the ongoing applause. Unbeknownst to him, Franklin Delano Roosevelt is waiting to deliver the last campaign speech of his long and storied political career. Red, white, and blue bunting covers the stadium. The surface of the old ballpark is dark. Roosevelt stands tall atop the speaker's platform in center field, stretched up to his full 6'2" height, awash in the cheers of 40,000 Bostonians and bathed in a brightness by giant spotlights shining down on him from atop the roof. FDR has been president of the United States for nearly 12 years and is just days away from being elected to a record fourth term. He wears a gray fedora and thick gray overcoat on this brutally cold autumn night. His legs are withered and weak from the polio that has long ravaged his body. Even with steel braces encircling his hips, thighs, and knees, FDR must grip the lectern to balance himself. This is not my first visit to Boston, Roosevelt reminds the crowd, gently trying to calm their boisterousness. The president's subtle request for quiet is spoken into the microphone in that genteel upper-crust voice that these working-class men and women recognize from the radio. But the good people of Boston refuse to sit down and let him speak. Most have never glimpsed the president in person until this moment. Indeed, many have only heard his voice and seen his picture in the Boston Globe. Free admission reads the ticket that got all of them into Fenway Park on this cold Saturday night. Bring your friends. And they did. The voices of those cheering are made up of men too old to fight, veterans home on leave, rosy-cheeked young children, and Gold Star mothers, those mournful women who have lost a son in combat. The night is being broadcast nationwide on the radio. Festivities began with 28-year-old Italian-American matinee idol Frank Sinatra singing the national anthem. Sinatra's given name is Francis, but he claims that he was inspired to name his newborn son, Frank Jr., after the president. What a guy, Sinatra marvels after his performance, referring to Roosevelt, and boy, does he pack a man. Despite the adoration of the public, Roosevelt is not a man of the people. He was born into wealth and privilege and has never known hard labor. As a young man, FDR collected stamps and shot birds, which he then stuffed himself and put on display. These are his hobbies to this very day. The president still spends his free time tending to the more than 1 million stamps in his possession. And his bird collection is on display at the family home in Hyde Park. Somewhat ironically, he speaks fluent German, thanks to his early years of schooling in Germany near the warm springs at Bad Nauheim, where his father temporarily moved the family so that the elder Roosevelt might recuperate from a heart problem. The cure did not take, and FDR's father died when Franklin was just 18, leaving the future president a sizable inheritance that would ensure him a life of luxury. His wealth made him stuffy and elitist, even as his foppish behavior led his cousin Alice Roosevelt, daughter of Franklin's macho distant cousin Teddy, to sneer that FDR was a good little mother's boy. She took to insulting FDR's manhood even further by giving him the nickname Miss Nancy. At age 20, Franklin married Eleanor Roosevelt, his fifth cousin and the niece of Teddy Roosevelt. While he was at first madly in love with Eleanor, he found his affection soon waned. FDR is a man who craves constant approval, and he chafed at Eleanor's constant criticism. The range of her scorn included their bedroom activities. Although their fruitful marriage has produced six children, Eleanor once stated that sex with FDR was an ordeal to be endured. Their relationship is now a platonic political arrangement, as it has been since Eleanor caught Franklin having an affair with her social secretary almost 30 years ago. The American people know none of this. Despite FDR's upper-crust mannerisms, his public policies have done much to benefit the working class, and the folks love him. In Roosevelt, they see a man who led the nation out of a crippling economic depression. They see a president who brought the nation together in the devastating wake of the Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. They see a president who has gone to great lengths to assist the German Jews who are now being persecuted in their homeland, even going so far as to recall the American ambassador to Germany, thus enduring the rage of American anti-Semites. And they see the commander-in-chief who has guided the country so skillfully through 3 long years of war. The good people of Boston have turned out in force this evening to show their gratitude. I shall not review all my previous visits. I should have to go on talking for several days to do that, Roosevelt says into the microphone, the veteran politician making a joke in the hope that a ripple of laughter will get the people to sit down so that he might speak. It doesn't help. The cheering continues. Outside Fenway Park, the crowd is even larger. The sidewalks are packed all the way out to Kenmore Square, about a quarter mile away. Some in the throng are able to brag that they were also on hand when the president's cousin, former U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt, spoke at Fenway back in 1914, just as the First World War was breaking out in Europe. But Teddy came in the summer during the warmth of the baseball season. This is different. Roosevelt has come at a time of freezing temperatures. On his way into Fenway just moments ago, sound wagons blaring patriotic songs preceded him. To counter rumors that he's in poor health, Roosevelt made sure the top was down in the Sunshine Special, as his bulletproof black Lincoln limousine is known. The president looked vigorous and strong, seemingly unbothered by the damp chill of the night, as he drove into Fenway with the famous actor and director, Orson Welles, sitting right next to him in the back seat. "Nice lights," Welles said in awe as the Lincoln turned left, appropriately as the liberal president will joke with his Secret Service protection. Welles was the warm-up act at Fenway and did his job splendidly. With his deep, dramatic voice and Shakespearean delivery, Orson Welles insisted that the nation must elect Roosevelt to a fourth term. The director, who has achieved lasting fame with the movie Citizen Kane, had Fenway at a fever pitch long before Roosevelt clamored as gracefully as possible to the lectern to speak. Now comes a delicate moment for Franklin Roosevelt. He must maintain Welles' momentum while hiding the fact that he is, in the language of the day, a cripple. In 1921, at the age of 39, he was afflicted with polio, a stunning blow to the privileged man. Since then, he has seen that great doses of funding have gone to cure the disease, but to no end. The president now spends his days in a wheelchair, a fact that can be easily concealed in pictures of him sitting behind the Oval Office desk or at the wheel of a car. But he is not completely paralyzed and has never lost his roving eye. FDR maintains a bevy of mistresses, among them his personal secretary, a sixth cousin, and even a former princess from Sweden. But there are no long walks in Franklin Delano Roosevelt's life, no hikes, no midnight rambles on the White House lawn. The only time his paralysis becomes a serious issue is at moments like this, when tens of thousands of people are watching his every move. He must rise and stand so that not a soul outside his closest circle will ever know of his health problems. Roosevelt has practiced and plotted and seen to the evening's every last detail. His car was driven through center field garage and straight up a ramp onto the speaker's platform. When it came time to get out of the car and move to the lectern, Roosevelt continued the ruse by holding a cane and leaning on the arm of an advisor. Since his legs will not move, Roosevelt must swing his hips from side to side in a much-practiced method of forward movement. He would never dare let this or any other crowd know that he is paralyzed, for that would convey weakness. In a time of world war, a man such as Roosevelt must be made of the same sturdy timber as Adolf Hitler, Winston Churchill, and Joseph Stalin. But there is a far greater truth behind Roosevelt hiding his affliction. America is not ready for a paralyzed president. A nation that is intolerant of racial differences is even more unable to come to terms with physical handicaps. Truth be told, Roosevelt's physical problems extend far beyond his polio. He suffers from hypertension. He has bronchitis. After a lifetime of smoking cigarettes, his lung function is compromised, and he often assumes a gray pallor. He cannot ride on a train traveling more than 35 miles an hour because the atrophied muscles in his lower body are unable to absorb the vibration. In a word, Franklin Roosevelt is dying. The greatest cause is something he cannot even see. Roosevelt's arteries are completely clogged and hardened, so much so that when he dies, the embalmer will be unable to poke a needle into them. Yet FDR now stands out in the cold, just like any veteran politician seeking re-election. This is something he must do. The race between him and Republican nominee Thomas Dewey is just too close. So he endures a cold Boston night, just as he endured a four-hour car ride through New York City in the rain 2 weeks ago. Nothing must stop him from re-election. Radio time costs a lot of money, Roosevelt finally barks into the microphone. There's a moment of stunned silence. This voice is not that of a frail old man or of one who is tentative about speaking his mind. It is the sound of ultimate authority. Franklin Roosevelt, despite the physical maladies that have made him a shell of his former self, is the most powerful man in the world. His decisions will determine the fate of people and nations and even the shape of the global map for decades to come. So as Roosevelt talks, the people of his nation listen. The crowd finally sits down. FDR speaks for 35 minutes before being bundled into his Lincoln and driven back to his train, the Ferdinand Magellan, by his Secret Service detail. His speech has been a rousing success, touching on a wide array of themes, including race relations, the rise of trade unions, and America's diversity. FDR points out the fact that the U.S. Army is comprised of the Murphys and the Kellys, the Smith and the Joneses, the Cohens and the Carusos, the Kowalskis and the Schultzes, the Olsons, the Swobodas, and right in with all the rest of them, the Cabots and the Lowells. He's saying that everyone from all strata of American society is doing his part. The massive fighting force that has banded together to battle its way across Europe is not just a combination of the established wealthy and Irish, Italian, Jewish, Polish, and Scandinavian immigrants, but of blacks as well. To the people of Boston, most of whom come from Irish and Italian stock, and who can remember the words Irish need not apply when seeking jobs, those words are a heartfelt reminder that the nation is changing for the better. Not everyone believes this to be true. Many believe that FDR's strategy of government-funded jobs and public works projects of the New Deal were socialistic, even though they may have rescued the nation from the Great Depression. Roosevelt's Republican opponent in the election of 1944, New York Governor Thomas Dewey, has relentlessly attacked FDR for promoting a form of communism. But Franklin Roosevelt is not a communist any more than Thomas Dewey plays center field for the Yankees. FDR is a natural leader whose foremost objective is to push the nation into a positive direction First as governor of New York in 1928, then as a legendary first 100 days as president in 1933, when he realized that drastic experiments in government were required to halt the four-year economic slide that was being called the Great Depression. The American dream had evaporated. One-fourth of all American workers were out of a job. Banks were failing. Poverty was epidemic. The American people felt that they were on their own. The government to whom they paid taxes and the men they voted into office were either unwilling or unable to fix the problems. Millions of Americans were desperate. Families were falling apart, and prosperity looked as if it might never return. Working closely with Congress, Roosevelt crafted a series of 15 bills that fixed the banking system and made possible a number of monumental public works projects designed to put Americans back on the job. Thus began the long climb back to prosperity. Republicans and Democrats set aside their differences and worked closely to get Roosevelt's ideas passed into law. They enacted the legislation so quickly that comedian Will Rogers joked on the radio that Congress didn't vote on the bills, they just wave as they pass by. FDR's social experiments have worked. The American dream has been revived, and the nation is reaching new heights of prosperity because of the production necessary during World War II. But those new laws also drastically expanded the size and reach of the federal government. This has made some voters angry. More than 150 years since Americans fought for independence and deposed a king, the specter of a powerful authority controlling private lives is alienating many citizens. And Dewey feeds that discontent by comparing large government with the oppression of communism. Tonight in Fenway Park, Roosevelt fires back. He speaks out against communism, distancing himself and his administration from what many in the world, even Adolf Hitler, perceive as the world's greatest threat. "We want neither communism nor monarchy," Roosevelt tells the crowd. "We want to live under our Constitution." But Roosevelt says nothing about which sort of government will rule post-war Europe. One thing is for certain, thanks to him, communism will play a very large role. Winston Churchill isn't the only one making deals with Joseph Stalin. Franklin Roosevelt has made a number of secret arrangements with the Soviet leader, dividing the post-war world between America and the communist Soviet Union. Giving eastern Poland, for example, to the Soviets is just a start. The high-stakes nature of the global intrigue being played out in Washington, Moscow, London, and Berlin means that FDR can trust very few people. It's quite clear, however, that he needs someone to represent him in this new turbulent world. Even if FDR were not president of the United States, his physical handicaps would not allow him to parachute behind enemy lines. His world-famous jaunty profile does not allow him to go undercover, and the constraints of his office do not allow him to perform the unethical work of political assassinations or other messy intrigues. But war is war, and lethal things must be done. So FDR has appointed one special individual to do the dirty work. The man's name is William Wild Bill Donovan. At age 61, Donovan is just a year younger than the president. The two have known each other since they were classmates at Columbia Law School. But there, the similarities end. Roosevelt is a liberal, while Donovan is a staunch conservative Republican. Roosevelt is in failing health. Donovan is so robust and larger than life that he seems bulletproof. And while Roosevelt is happiest basking in the adulation of a large crowd, the swaggering Donovan prefers to work in the shadows. Even before the war began, Roosevelt brought in this quick-thinking former attorney and Medal of Honor winner to be his global eyes and ears, and Donovan has done a spectacular job. As Roosevelt gives his speech in Fenway Park on this cold Saturday night, Wild Bill is busy sabotaging America's relationship with Winston Churchill and Great Britain in order that the USA and the Soviet Union can achieve a tighter bond. Donovan's location seems innocuous enough. He's at home in Washington, D.C., safe and secure in his Tony Georgetown mansion on 30th Street. Donovan has a sizable fortune and lives a lavish lifestyle that would make few suspect he is America's top spy. Yet Donovan's Office of Strategic Services, OSS, as his covert group of top secret operatives he commands is known, is in constant contact with him. While he might be relaxing at home, Donovan is well aware that troops of the Red Army are rolling into Yugoslavia on board American tanks, trucks, and jeeps. Donovan soon orders that 10 tons of medical supplies be flown into the Balkans at U.S. expense, an extravagance that will greatly assist the communist takeover. The OSS is also sowing seeds of discord in Greece, the country that Winston Churchill covets more than any other. Thus begins a sideshow to the war itself, the undercover battle led by William Donovan and the OSS to ensure that Eastern Europe falls into the hands of Soviet Russia. Above all else, FDR does not want a confrontation with the Soviet Union. He thinks of Joseph Stalin as his friend and a true ally. Better to let Stalin have a part of the world where the United States has few interests. And even when Winston Churchill complains the Soviet expansion is hurting England, it is explained to him that Donovan is out of control and unstoppable. I've always been worried by his predilection for political intrigue. General Walter Bedell Beadle Smith, one of Dwight Eisenhower's top staff members, writes to Churchill about Donovan, and have kept a firm hand on him so he keeps away from me as much as possible. But Wild Bill Donovan reports only to the President of the United States. 2 weeks after that triumphant night in Fenway Park, Franklin Roosevelt relaxes in the White House, safely reelected to a fourth term. No other American president has ever served this long. Roosevelt sits at his Oval Office desk in his wheelchair, the one specially built to look as much as possible like a normal piece of office furniture. The day is not a busy one, not beginning until almost noon with a private meeting with the British Admiral James Somerville. A war hero has just been assigned to Washington as head of Britain's naval delegation. Later on, there will be a brief reception with a group of female newspaper correspondents and a small formal dinner for 14 guests in the cavernous East Room of the White House. The affair will be short, lasting from 7:30 to precisely 9 p.m. Roosevelt will rattle around the White House for three more hours after that, but the time will be unstructured, unplanned, and completely his own. November 18, 1944, will mark that rarest of all days for a wartime president, one without crisis. But today will one day be seen to hold monumental significance, thanks to a memo Roosevelt now grasps in his hand. Typed and organized into a single sheet in the form of a letter, it arrived between appointments. The memo comes straight from the desk of Wild Bill Donovan, who has scrawled his signature at the bottom. Roosevelt personally requested this piece of paper on October 31st, Halloween. Its highly confidential contents will soon be leaked, through no fault of Roosevelt's, and he will be forced to defend Donovan when the newspapers report that the OSS chief is trying to create an American Gestapo. When that moment comes, Roosevelt will have no choice but to distance himself from Donovan in the same manner as Beadle Smith. Noting to an aide that Donovan loves power for its own sake, Roosevelt will try to find a way to harness that guy, because if we don't, he'll be doing a lot of things other than what we want him to do. But Roosevelt has no intention of stopping Donovan, because Wild Bill is doing exactly what FDR wants. Pursuant to your note of October 31, 1944, Donovan writes, I have given consideration to the formation of an intelligence service for the post-war period. Minutes of war, we're also in a period of transition, he adds. We have now in the government a trained and specialized personnel needed for the task. Neither Roosevelt nor Donovan has any further concern about the German army. The war will soon be won. That is a foregone conclusion. And just as Donovan once traveled the globe at Roosevelt's behest in the days before Pearl Harbor, warning that the United States should expand its Navy and Army in anticipation of the day it would join the war, Roosevelt now asks him to see the future once again. Both men anticipate another great conflict might follow once Germany is defeated. But rather than suffer another surprise attack, as at Pearl Harbor, Donovan is pressing Roosevelt to allow him to design a new post-war intelligence agency that will anticipate clear and present dangers. In the absence of openly belligerent enemies, this new agency's role will be to spy on America's friends as well as her adversaries. Roosevelt endorses the new group. His typewritten reply is signed simply FDR. And so, the Central Intelligence Agency is born. As history will show, both Roosevelt and Donovan are taking their eyes off the ball much too early. Adolf Hitler and the armies of Nazi Germany are far from conquered. As Wild Bill Donovan strategizes about post-war power consolidation, Wehrmacht soldiers, guns, and tanks are quietly grouping near the German border. They do so under strict radio silence, lest the Americans hear their chatter and anticipate the biggest surprise attack since Pearl Harbor. The Germans face west toward the American lines in the thick wilderness in Belgium known as the Ardennes Forest. It is here that U.S. forces are weakest, because it is assumed that an attack through this primeval wood is impossible. To tilt the odds even further in the Germans' favor, it has been ascertained that George Patton and his Third Army are more than 100 miles southeast, still in dire need of gasoline, guns, and soldiers, and still unable to conquer Metz. Hitler and his generals are sure that Operation Watch on the Rhine will be a successful counterattack that not even the great George Patton can thwart. The Nazis are poised to turn defeat into victory with this counterattack and the development of a new atomic weapon that Hitler believes is almost ready. The Führer is certain of ultimate victory. Very certain. Chapter 6. War Room, 3rd Army Headquarters, Nancy, France, December 9th, 1944, 7 a.m. Colonel Oscar Koch thinks Hitler is up to something. The G2, as General Patton's top intelligence officer is known in military parlance, is certain that the German army is far from defeated. In fact, he is the only intelligence officer on the Allied side who believes that the Wehrmacht is poised to launch a withering Christmas counteroffensive. Only until now, nobody will listen to him. The sun has not yet risen on what promises to be another bitter cold and wet day in eastern France. Koch stands amid the countless maps lining the walls of his beloved war room, 30 miles south of the front lines. The 46-year-old career soldier stands ramrod straight. He's bald and wears thick glasses that give him a professorial air. Just a few feet away, George S. Patton sits in a straight-backed wooden chair as Koch begins the morning intelligence briefing. Patton wears a long overcoat and scarf to ward off the cold, even indoors. He is pensive and eager to be once again on the attack. In just 10 days, Patton is launching his Operation Tink, a bold new offensive that will take the Third Army into the heart of Nazi Germany for the first time. Metz has finally fallen after 2 long months of siege. Patton systematically worked his way toward Metz, bypassing the network of forts as needed, while at the same time depriving their inhabitants of food and water. Fort Trient surrendered on December 8, 1944. The invasion of Germany now awaits. Patton plans to cross the Rhine and press hard toward Frankfurt, then on to Berlin. Unlike many generals who plan an attack without first consulting their G2, Patton relies heavily on Koch, and with good reason. A humble veteran soldier who worked his way up through the ranks, Koch is perhaps the most driven man on Patton's staff. He is consumed with the task of collecting information on every aspect of the battlefield. Koch arranges for reconnaissance planes to fly over enemy positions, and then as a team of draftsmen constructs precise terrain maps of the towns, rivers, railway lines, fence lines, creeks, farm buildings, bridges, and other obstacles that might slow down the Third Army's advance. Koch also arranges for German-speaking American soldiers to exchange their military uniforms for peasant clothing at night and travel behind enemy lines, mingling in bars and restaurants to collect information about Wehrmacht troop movements. And Koch and his team carefully scrutinize data radioed back from the front lines by American patrols. Every bit of that information comes together in the war room's centerpiece, an enormous series of maps detailing the entire Western Front. British, American, Canadian, French, and German positions are all carefully marked. The map's transparent acetate coverings are marked in greased pencil, with special notations for armored, infantry, and artillery. Each unit is denoted by a special symbol. Once an army is on the move, its progress is closely tracked. A rag made wet with alcohol wipes the acetate clean, and a unit's new location is once again marked in greased pencil. In this way, Colonel Oscar Koch knows with almost pinpoint accuracy the location of every tank, howitzer, airfield, fuel dump, supply depot, railway station, and infantry detachment between Antwerp and Switzerland. And that, Koch now explains to Patton as the general listens with his usual intensity, is what troubles him. There is something missing. The Third Army's proposed route across the Rhine and into Germany is defended by a small and vulnerable German force. So in all likelihood, Patton's Operation Tink will begin as a rousing success, though Koch never goes out on a limb to predict a victory. War is too uncertain. But Koch goes on to point out a real problem lies further north, on what will be the Third Army's left flank during Operation Tink. In particular, Koch is wary of an enormous German troop buildup, despite the fact that the roads are empty.